Patients Association in its relatively early days.
I was working at MPA from 1973 to 75.
What was your position?
I think I started out as the newspaper coordinator, and then I simply became sort of the administration coordinator for a while. And at that stage, as I recall, this is 20 years ago now, it was still, MPA still conceived of itself pretty much in a lot of the original terms as an independent, adversarial, opposition, mental patients, democratically controlled, anarchistically operating kind of organization.
Lanny has said to me that it was primarily a service organization, a mutual aid organization. Would you agree with that?
It had a lot of politics, though, and it had a public role in Vancouver and even beyond Vancouver, which argued a kind of radical psychology, anti-psychiatry line. At least, you know, in terms of appearing publicly. And then people would be invited on, you know, television, or we would be going to some, you know, like government agency to present a position of some sort. And
thanks.
There was, of course, a lot of emphasis on there was a lot of emphasis on the ability of people to do for themselves a lot. It had a lot of features of self-help in the sense that it had houses where people could live in a drop-in center, and there was concern about providing mediation between individuals and various government agencies that, you know, provide things like welfare funding or...
So it had an advocacy function.
But it had a very... definite advocacy and education function. Go to schools and have these kinds of conversations. And then the newspaper itself, which was called In a Nutshell, carried a lot of, you know, sort of ideological writing. And also, even maybe deeper than that, ideological assumptions about how to view all this. What I'm trying to remember is... And maybe you can remember this, is when did the community mental health proposals come around? Because we went to those meetings.
Yeah, 73.
You and I were at those meetings at Kitt's house. And we were very wary of whether or not this was designed to undermine organizations like MPA and sort of, you know, normalize them and then control them. In a way, and then the other feature of it is that within MPA itself, there were a lot of people who, you know, weren't interested in politics. They were interested in their lives, or, you know, simply socializing and finding a way out of whatever their situation was. And so, the politics of it didn't matter so much to them, and there were. There were people.
Sure.
There were people who were elected to jobs at MPA. All the jobs were by election of the membership. Who were probably, you know, just more interested in doing that job, and they had their own kind of stance toward it, and their own kind of views toward people. And then the one other kind of structural feature of it is, and this was especially true during the time that I was there, is that the organization became invested in the community. That is, we now are suddenly owning property and having to administer it. I remember the one thing that I was responsible for was buying this building that housed the drop-in center, and it was a whole apartment block that had existing tenants, and we had to deal with the existing tenants and both reassure them and also make policy for what would happen as they moved out, if they moved out, and utilizing the drop-in center. So we had a lot of, and we were acquiring additional houses, I think, during that period. So there was, those are all sort of like conservativizing features of the organization. And then there was another organization, Coast Foundation. And we saw them as the ideologically conservative mental health organization, an independent but conservative organization. But increasingly we were having relations with them about housing people. And
They did nothing but housing.
Yeah, we were coordinating relations with them. So those were features of it. But as I recall, by 75, when I went to another job, it was still politically saw itself as a opposition kind of organization. And there was a kind of, there was a very strong, first of all, there were sort of constitutional features that had been built into the organization by Lanny, which were would take a very long time to undermine. That is the whole procedure of how power was exercised, how people got to hold jobs, the fact they were elected by the membership, that they were short term and that they had to be renewed every 6 months and you didn't have a sinecure. All of those things mitigated for democracy against a whole bunch of other things. Although it was certainly the case that there were influential people who, by the force of personality, could dominate the situation. And there was the split between people who had experienced psychiatric hospitalization and those who hadn't.
Those who hadn't, had they had some kind of psychiatric treatment?
No, not necessarily.
Who were they?
They were also people who simply wanted to work there in some way. And then the membership could decide whether to elect them or not, and there was a mix of people, and there was an effort to sort of balance that, and the idea, sort of built in early on, there was the notion that there should be some people there who didn't necessarily have psychiatric institutionalization experience.
Why should?
I don't quite remember. You did.
Well, it wasn't that there should be those people there, but rather it was that they shouldn't be excluded.
Okay.
And then there was, at some point it came to the point where there had to be at least 50% plus one the coordinators who had been hospitalized.
That's right.
And I think what I had said to you was that when it came down to it, that service preceded politics, which is the opposite of the forming of the left-wing groups. What I meant by that was essentially two things. One is really, I meant service preceded radical politics. One thing was that because of the democratic organization, those of us in leadership who were, quote, radical, didn't necessarily carry the line of everybody else. So people were quite willing to go, let us have a pretty long leash to work with that. And the other thing is because it was a, quote, service organization that provided housing for many, many people, you couldn't just go out there and say something that was going to jeopardize these people's houses.
Yeah. And that the idea of providing service as a base was itself a political notion. It was critical of leftist organizations who only had theories of how to change the world. And so the idea was to get grounded in practical things and not screw up the practical things and demonstrate a kind of competence.
The no halfway house idea.
Mm-hmm.
These are permanent residents,
yeah.
As long as people want to stay there.
Yeah, and there was no length of time and all that.
Other thing is that those were, quote, radical times, 70, 74, so it was really possible to say a whole lot of things at that time. I mean, it was a time in which psychiatry, in some sense, was retreating a bit. That was when, for example, homosexuality got knocked out of the DSM, 73, I think it was.
And I remember, there was also a time we were reading Lang and Cooper about the end of psychiatry, anti-psychiatry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even like liberals like Fritz Perls, for that matter, who had a different concept of what the psychiatrist was.
Yeah. And did you talk about the funniest things was our politics in action things when that usually had to do with going down to City Hall.
Yes.
And we would have to get some sort of a license for the house or a variance, or we had to assure the local neighborhood that this wasn't going to disrupt their lives forever. And so a whole batch of MPA people would turn up at the city council committee meeting, and along, you know, with those of us who were, you know, going to speak at the meeting.
And the guy sitting next to us who wanted to build a high-rise apartment on the beach.
There'd be all of those. But the thing that was interesting about it is that the sense of the people, you mean, like the day before, people could be screaming and yelling and their lives would be in like total disarray. And then all of a sudden, the next day, we would have to appear. Everybody would be on time. They'd bring their children, their dogs. And it was like the most respectable collection of people who had been done hard by, who would offer testimonies and all of this. And of course there was, for public officials, there was sort of the terror that they were in the presence of crazy people. That was like the primary feature of this, that they're in the presence of crazy people. Anything could happen, therefore. And then here would be these, you know, like grandmotherly figures who would, you know, explain how MPA had rescued them from 25 years on a back ward and had changed their lives and, you know, a whole range of things like that. It was enormously impressive, and I don't think we've ever lost a single one of those kinds of public hearings. I mean, it always, you know, that was, I mean, it was just remarkable the way people, you know, were able to get, and then people would go back and hear voices and scream and claim that, you know, so-and-so would beat me up. And this was also, we look back, I suppose, was, you know, sort of, at least I do, kind of romantic nostalgia for it, but I mean, that's the way it seems to me. I mean, while we're, you know, when we would go over to Patty's house and there would be a lot of blood all over the place and all of that in the middle of the night, that one, you know, that's, it seems like romantic nostalgia looking back on it. But the same thing was true of these meetings at MPA. The general meeting was hilarious in that anything could be an agenda item. And so I would, you know, I was like the, you know, the administrator. So I'd say, well, we have $100,000 such and such that we have to discuss. So that would be an agenda item. Earl hit me yesterday. That was an agenda item. And everything had equal weight. I mean, it was, you know, so that people would deal with those things. There were sort of relevant questions were asked about both personal squabbles and, you know, banking and interest rates and all of that. So, I mean, those kind of things seem, you know, just remarkable in retrospect.
And so what I inferred from that is ultra-democracy is a good thing at MPA. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the people, almost all the people are on welfare. People had nothing to do with their lives. The best thing people could do with it is spend 6-8 hours in a meeting talking about their actual lives.
Yeah, yeah. And we saw those as political in their essence. And also, I mean, the other thing is they did have a character that was different from other kinds of meetings, say like a meeting of academics. And this is the famous, what do you call it, the Machiavelli scale feature of it. That one of the, features of that of people being nuts is that they don't lie as much as other people. That is, they're not as good at lying, and that's one of the reasons they're nuts. And psychologists have conducted studies, like, or at least that's what I was told by you, about all this, and something called the Machiavelli scale, and people who have been hospitalized always score low on the Machiavelli scale.
Yes.
And there's a squirrel on the back porch. I heard a squirrel tapping this morning. But I think they're in the floorboards again. But one of the features that was noticeable about MPA for me was that you could just ask people about just anything, and there was very little resistance, you know, sort of resistance you'd encounter, say, at some other kind of meeting where people had personas to put on and, you know, things to uphold. So, I mean, there was a sort of kind of very direct quality. You ask the most, you know, bizarre questions and get a straight answer. So, that, again, it was an attractive feature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, we should try to... Now, remember, I'm still trying to figure... I mean, I'm sure that these mental health things was the first big, you know, step of this. I'm trying to remember what happened. We were hostile to them in a, you know, sort of way. I mean, we went into the meetings feeling kind of hostile toward the whole idea and were suspicious of it, and we saw that they were...
And they were trying to placate us and try to involve us and all that. But, see, those started, I think, in 74, 75. The meetings were in 73, so yeah. I don't know how big an effect they had at usurping whatever radical politics MPA had, although, again, the changing times, we're talking about 1975. I don't know at what point someone would look at MPA and say, well, it really is a pretty conservative organization, doesn't really stand for mental patients' rights, but rather just for mental patients' housing or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there was a changing political context, and then at some point MPA was working directly with these community care team kinds of things and helping to schedule appointments and getting benefits through them and all of that. It became the most available social agency, and it was a social agency that, quote, talked your language. In lots of ways and it was obviously not distant because they were plugging all over the it was a strategy of that was designed. It was meant to be a quote progressive strategy from the the old from River as the kind of divestment of Riverview.
I was startled in reading very early in a nutshell to see that psychiatrists were recruited to train people to help deal with crisis. I thought that was surprising because I would have thought that an organization with a sort of anti-psychiatry stance would think that psychiatrists don't know how to deal with crisis and that's the last people you go to.
Well, I mean, it's very selective. That is, like, within psychiatry, there are some people who are anti-psychiatric, like Zaz and so on. Mm-hmm. So these are a handful of progress, like Eric Leyland, for example.
Right.
I think there were three or four who came around, and it was part of trying not to make MPA isolated from what's called the community. And seeing that having ties with progressive professionals was a good thing.
Okay. Do you know anything about what's up with MPA now?
No.
Okay.
No. Not really.
Okay.
It's on Burrard now.
It was on 4th near Burrard. Is that where you mean?
Yeah, on 4th, I mean. That's right. On 4th near Burrard.
And it's apparently next door to the Kitts community care team, or it was as of some years ago.
It still has a drop-in center.
So I think the last I heard it was on 4th near Burrard, and it was next door to the Kitts community care team.
Hmm. What should I ask him?
See, I mean, for the period of time after MPA, I mean, it had this initial time when it flourished and grew very quickly. It couldn't have continued to grow much more after that. I mean, there was just a limit as to how many apartment blocks and houses we could have. It did acquire another apartment block, but most of the growth went on in that period, and most of the radical politics went on in that period. Then, I think it had sort of reached an asymptote about getting money. Like, it wasn't going to keep getting millions and millions more dollars. And the times were changing, and personnel were changing. And I really know very, very little about what happened after I left.
And I moved up to northern BC, so
okay.
That was really out of the picture.
Did you know anything about the Emotional Emergency Center?
Tom was involved in that. It went on for a year or so, I think,
yeah.
And they got some lit grant to do it.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of R.D. Lang kind of
what was it called?
Emotional
Emergency Center.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
They had a house on Quebec. Well, the Vancouver, that's right, Vic.
That's
Vancouver.
Right, Vic.
That's right. Vic,
yeah. They had a house at Quebec, and
that's right.
I've been to the house, not house. But, and MPA people used to go there. I mean, it was a place, but it wasn't RD land in the sense we go for a long time. It was a crisis center, so people would go there for periods of like a few days to a week, often. I think it was, you know, they wanted to get people out so that new people could get in.
And it wasn't an MPA thing, they were just people in common.
Yeah.
That's right. It didn't have any formal ties, but lots of friendship ties. Marnie was very involved in that.
That's right.
When I was involved with her.
Yeah.
And Tom, and one of Tom's, somebody Allen, a woman named somebody Allen that Tom was involved with. So, as I recall, Veek ran that one house. They had one house, and they ran it, and it was pretty much, the people there pretty much were in the R.D. Lang ideology.
Yeah, Gestalt therapy.
Can you give me a little summary of the R.D. Lang ideology?
Well, I guess I'd say it was it viewed schizophrenia from a point of view of cultural determinism. That is, it saw it as being a product of mostly family failures or family successes, as the family is a dysfunctional socializing agency. And so basically people were driven crazy, learning schizophrenic, and that's why this book, The Pilot Itself, was... He was interested in schizophrenia, which most people weren't. Like Freud was not particularly interested in schizophrenia, and so he and Cooper set up this center where people could come and, I mean, but at this point it sounds quite cliche. That is, there'd be no drugs, you know, there'd be autonomy for the people and so on, and some idea that people who are given that kind of warm and free and loving environment would get better.
And was schizophrenia seen as a disease?
No, it's a journey.
Right. Okay.
As an experience.
It was the Paul's experience in Bird of Paradise. So, no, he didn't see it as illness, even though he was a psychiatrist.
I've heard him criticized for romanticizing madness and making it pretty when it isn't. What do you guys think of that?
I agree to some extent, but I'm very. Usually I haven't, and especially now, like, anybody I see is, like, leaning in a progressive direction. I'm not interested in cutting the legs out from under them. And I think he did romanticize madness. I think Sass can be viciously cruel in the face of people's pain. But for both of them, I say they're both good people to have in the environment, in the intellectual environment.
Didn't romanticize alcoholism, though. He's lying. He didn't romanticize alcoholism.
No, I know.
Did he practice it?
I think so.
Yeah. And he died young.
Very young. On the tennis court.
Jerry Garcia died young.
That too.
Someone said, no, that's now the end of the 60s. It had been buried for the 300,000th time. Okay, now it's really dead.
I was saying in Berlin this year that this was finally the end of World War II.
Yes. Paul McCartney will die in like 2045. So that's the end of the 60s.
But the main thing was that Lang was interesting. Lang, Cooper, Esterson seemed interesting to us. That is, they had, they consciously, and Lang, and Cooper both come out of reading the works of Sartre, and, you know, sort of consciously viewed the world as existential, as circumstantial, as situations and situated. And suddenly, and I think things like the divided self, which was, I guess, among the beginnings of Lang's writing that I heard about, just seemed tremendously interesting about how to reconceive ourselves and reconceive our troubles. And so that was just really exciting. It seemed, and also it was very political in the sense of it was against an establishment of which these people were practitioners.
It saw that the established order as being responsible, largely not just through the institution of the family, but largely through the institution of the family driving people crazy. It was an insane society that produced divided cells.
Yeah, and that's just, this seemed intellectually like a, you know, very fresh way of sort of reconceiving of ourselves. And of course, in the larger context, we were, you know, there were just every kind of experiment to reconceive of community, of family, of self going on in the society. And so this coming from within people who had heretofore claimed a kind of knowledge, but these people were breaking ranks with that institution of psychiatry, so that seemed to, you know, to fit into the picture that a lot of us were engaged in at the time. So that was part of the excitement. And I suppose retrospectively, you know, having read subsequent accounts of what was called the Philadelphia Association, that, yeah, Lang was just wrong in various ways and was, you know, it was part of his projection.
How wrong?
In the sense of that just all he had to do was, you know, create this situation and that would solve
okay.
it in,
so
in some sense. Yeah, that is because the situation wasn't within the walls of Philadelphia Association, but was within the whole society. There was also just the sense of people's pain that we encountered, just, you know, in you know, everyday life, people had problems, and we tended to analyze them socially. There was no, quote, therapy offered at MPA. That was one of its ideological premises, that there wasn't any therapy to be offered. There was just, we were there, and we would talk to each other or to anyone who, you know, came through or would put up with us. But that none of this would count as any special kind of talk. We may not have been aware of it enough, but there were certainly features of power and authority, that is, by virtue of personality and our coping skills and all of that, various of us could accrue kind of, you know, an authority within the organization, so that people would say, oh, ask so-and-so about this, or so-and-so would have the final word in a certain sense. But that, you know, that's sort of the everyday power grabbing that goes on in ordinary life.
But part of MPA that was similar roughly to the things that Saz was saying, a lot of things were sort of commonsensical. The ordinary person sort of sees crazy people commonsensically up to a certain point, and then there's a break, and then you need to bring in the professionals. So we, for example, the cliche that people went into the hospital, returned to the community. Well, there was no community.
Yeah.
What there was a series of collections of people, most of whom were hostile to the people who came out of. So as I say, so MPA was really trying to create a community, and in some sense really did create a community for people who had never belonged to one before. Like for me, I had never belonged to a community like that before.
I suppose you talked about this already, but the one kind of thing we couldn't do, but that we theoretically had the notion of, had to do with the question of work.
Work and sex were two.
Yeah, but then did you talk about this already?
Not so much about work.
Okay, the work, that we saw as really the main thing we couldn't do. And the idea that we had was, you know, it was obvious that people needed places to live, needed food, needed social contact, but people also needed work in the world, so they weren't utterly dependent on agencies and all of that.
And then he did get work at MPA.
Right.
Yeah.
When I left, there were 25 people.
Yeah.
Most of them crazy people?
At least half.
Yeah.
But the big idea was that people should have jobs, and they should have jobs in a regular place.
Yeah.
With other regular people, and the idea was I think our fantasy was to find the beneficent capitalist boss.
Through the NDP.
Yeah.
And approach Norm Levy.
That's right.
And say, find the factory where there's an idle conveyor belt.
That's right.
And we'll put people on it, they'll get paid. One of the people will be somebody who's very unlikely to freak out, so he'll be the sort of one who, if somebody else does,
and that people would have first, but and that the proposal was that he would have different kinds of hours, and that there'd be the possibility of taking a break when you're getting sort of
work
antsy,
and stuff like that.
But you know that you could stop work, which is what you're not allowed to do in the factory.
Well, I was telling about Rob, who tends to be able to get a job and work well for 3 or 4 months and completely fucks up, and so he can't go back to that job. So that would be the thing, somebody can completely fuck up and go away for 3 months and then come back and get the job.
And that we saw that as, you know, if you could do that. Now that immediately sort of took us into the, you know, the actual world of how capitalist work is organized, and we never did it. We weren't able to get over that, and we saw that as necessary if people were to have sort of more complete lives, because you just simply, you know, people have to work in one way or another. But it was a good idea, and it seems to me retrospectively to still be a good idea.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it also undercut the notion of the sheltered workshop, which seemed to us like a bad idea and a stigmatizing idea and a ghettoizing idea. And that this was seen as one of the, you know, just as the houses were located in neighborhoods, even though people, you know, who had common experiences were living together, that working in the real world was also a kind of way of reintegrating your life. And that's what we couldn't do.
As a pilot project, we theoretically could have done it. If the NDP stayed in power 7-5 only, if it stayed in power long, and there was somebody who was there to
push
it, probably push it enough, you could get it and say, well, here's a model kind of project. But so, I mean, in some ways, I look back on MPA as being a utopian community that succeeded within the terms of being a utopian community, and beyond that did not succeed. I mean, the notion of what we talked about, the stigma of mental illness, is probably stronger now than it was then. It certainly has not been beaten back. There weren't inroads. I mean, that is, mental patients' lives today are not better than they were then, in some ways, or worse. It varies. Backwards have gone, but, you know, street madness is here and all of that.
And community mental health is totally oppressive, as I found out working for the Kitsano mental health team.
Well, you have some interesting documents.
Yes, which I'm going to pick up when I'm on the ski and I'll show it to you.
So maybe that's it. I mean, so maybe if we say it's not romanticizing, it was an attempt to make a utopian community.
Very
and
much.
Within its own definition, it worked pretty well for about 4 or 5 years, and then it started to skid for reasons. I don't know who the principals were. I don't think I blame them. It would just attract more conservative people into leadership roles.
Yeah. And again, context with the larger political context. Because, I mean, we'd say the same thing about communes and various other kinds of alternatives. How did the Georgia Strait move from being a newspaper of an opposition into being an entertainment newspaper?
When did that happen?
I'm not sure. Mid-70s.
Okay.
Because I remember we had broken with the Georgia Strait, and I was part of a thing called the Western Voice, which is a newspaper of the proletariat. It was equally bad fantasy. But it had an idea. And then it was again after that the Georgia Strait completely became an entertainment paper for a long period of time, and it's only in the last 5 years that it's now becoming more like an interesting newspaper that has feature articles and, you know, now that it's making huge amounts of money. It pays writers very well for doing features, and so it has much, you know, it's becoming more like Village Voice. And it ceased to be simply, you know, it's still the bulk of it is this kind of flack for movies and stuff, but it went through a long period from the mid-70s through the 80s, where it was simply, you know, sort of rewrites for Hollywood publicity stuff. And that
about locked out his workers at one point.
That was very early on.
That was mid-70s.
That
was when the Georgia Grape split off, and then became the Grape, and then became
the Western Voice.
Grape was a good idea, as I remember.
Its effort to be a kind of community paper. And I just keep emphasizing this context, MPA in context is really a crucial thing to keep it, pay attention to, I think. Because the you know, that marker of the mid-70s, end the Vietnam War, I remember we held the, this sort of public, at this other organization, as part of, we held this public celebration of the end of the war.
April 75, I think, was in the American, was when finally the Saigon fell, became Ho Chi Minh City.
And somehow after that, it's just what I've got in mind is, like, change really did occur. And leftists who wanted to go on being leftists of a certain kind ended up more and more marginalized in these Marxist-Leninist groupings. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people, little friends of ours, sort of had that experience, which was...
And already on the assembly line, you've got Reagan is coming up, and Thatcher, and Mulroney, and all those. By the 80s, it's a real political ice age. So I don't know how MPA could have survived in this earlier form. I mean, eventually you're going to have some bureaucrats going to say, what about this group of people? Why don't we have somebody sitting on the board? Why don't we have somebody, you know, in the houses and so on? So I think now there is a professional from the welfare department who's connected to the houses or something like that. But there's an actual interacting between MPA and government in administering services. I don't know how that divides up in percentages.
Now... So you think the Georgia Strait is becoming more political in the last 5 years, huh?
Without question.
And do you think so too?
Yeah, I tend not to read it very much.
Okay. Because you and I were talking about how we are still in a reactionary time. The world has gone to hell in a handbasket. How does that jive with the Georgia Strait getting more political?
The world isn't absolutely uniform. I mean, so Georgia Strait is a little tiny. I mean, it's more liberal, it's not particularly radical. It's not a socialist paper.
No. But it's socially critical.
No, I don't think it would necessarily shrink from publishing, like, socialist views.
Not necessarily, yeah, I agree. And, you know, they publish Terry Glavin and all the people who have left sort of daily journalism and now are sort of out there as independents.
Well, I mean, another thing is that the Georgia Strait's a freebie, so that probably the large majority of people pick it up for the entertainment news.
Oh, yeah, no question about that. But it is a paper that now people like me will go and look at to see what their lead story is.
Have you written for them?
No. That's a little too much to ask. I was sort of involved in the founding of it, stuff like that. Although I've been written about in it, there was a review of the book that was in there, and somebody named Susie Gardner, who's a radio person, but I haven't brought myself.
Is it still Dan McLeod? Is still the publisher now?
And he writes from New York and Hollywood. Still the same interviews he's done for 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
I think he maybe lives in New York or something like that by now. But this thing makes over $1 million a year. And he can sell it for $20 million, I was told. I mean, these are things I can't conceive.
He got to be the guy who owned it because he was in math, but he knew how to take care of money, right? So he became the kind of, the bank account was sort of in his name. It was Georgia Strait, Dan McLeod. He was the only signing officer, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he had really founded it. Also. But it was true, he was in math. He was also sort of a poet at that.
Yes.
Part of Warren Tallman's group.
Very quiet.
He was an Andy Warhol figure. Fading away.
So I guess you have to, if you want to find out about him, what happened to MP, you got to talk to people.
I'm going to talk to Isabel Clyborne because that's what Judy Chamberlain said to do.
Who's this?
Isabel
Clyborne.
What, did she end up working there?
I don't know, but Judy Chamberlain said that would be a good person to talk to about how it became a bad thing.
Well, yes, I think in the 80s I heard that she was working there.
Uh-huh.
I remember thinking that was probably good thing, because she was, I sort of liked her and thought
yeah.
she was competent.
She's person. A friend of Tom's also.
Yeah, an old friend.
No. We were a kid. His name was Scott.
Yes. He just had his 45th birthday.
Something like that. It may have been. He was a skateboarder for a while. Yeah, you certainly have to talk to people who were there during the period.
Yeah, I will do that.
To say, you know, I myself have become now a proponent of communism too. So I've moved from communism one to communism two.
Communism the sequel. Coming in 50 years!
It's just inevitable, but it has to be reinvented.
Yes, it has to. It will be reinvented.
Yeah, yeah. And it has to... deal with the things that it couldn't deal with.
Yes. Meanwhile, the right wing it is in the process of reinventing itself,
mm-hmm.
very strongly reinventing itself.
Yeah. I mean, we have barbarism first.
Yeah.
But I mean,
and maybe barbarism last too.
Yeah. I mean, I've in my career in the neighborhood, I've moved a whole block and a half. So I now am a volunteer at the Suzuki Foundation. Which is located in Caperville, as we call this. This is this block of yuppieism on 4th Avenue.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole block, though, is, you know, like, it's one idea. And, of course, there's, and I mean, the real proof of the pudding was that they wouldn't allow a liquor store in that complex. They were too pure for a liquor store. Very bad sign.
Can you smoke outside?
You can smoke outside on the patio, but you can't smoke inside, of course.
You can smoke outside and suffer the ostracism.
Yeah, yeah. So Suzuki Foundation, of course, has its offices there, so it's like a block away from where the drop-in center used to be. Like, away from the drop-in center, so...
So it's like got Capers, which is a progressive Safeway. It's got Van City, which is a progressive bank in Montreal.
Yeah. Same thing, got a music store and the mountain equipment store.
Coast Mountain.
So it's exactly representative of the satisfactions and dissatisfactions of the present context in that way, because it's also it's a simulacrum rather than a reality of something different.
And it's located in an area where enough university professors live and so on. Kitsilano used to be kind of like hippie student progressive
artists.
An artist, yes,
lived here, and there were all of these little houses that, of which none are left.
East Street.
Yeah, but I mean, even here, these were all already bigger houses in this block. But they were all little houses. Then in the lanes, there were still beach shacks in the 60s. They were really just beach shacks.
When I reinvent my life, I start living in one of those when I'm about 23 years old. Stay there.
Yeah.
Put my body before the bulldozers. Unsuccessfully, of course.
Yeah. And then all of that gradually was pulled out. So, I mean, even the architectural changes will match the political changes and the ideological changes of MPA, probably. I mean, just if you sort of charted when the condos replaced the houses.
I think to maintain an organization that you'd say is politically radical, it cannot be open-ended like MPA was. You can't have a door in which anyone can walk in.
Say more about that. What do you do instead?
Well, you have, I mean, the Western Voice would be an example where, you know, this is a newspaper that was a spin-off times two from the Georgia Strait that was run by people who self-fashioned Marxist-Leninists and people who thought similarly, though Stan and I were people who thought similarly, but we felt quite excluded from the core of it and thought it was going in the wrong direction. You couldn't just walk in off the street and say, I want to work for the Western Voice. I mean, people did that, and they essentially said, get out of here, was what they said, because you couldn't come up into those meetings that we used to hold in the loft, right? Like, the idea was to make it as small as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really do think the idea was...
Well, I mean, it was a parody of itself that ended up with the official idea was that the masses would come and give their testimony and write them out. But it was just, it was a bizarre idea. And in reality, what was going on was the creation of a kind of cultist operation that obviously had to be smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
But with like MPA, again, its viability must be geared to the context of society.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a net, but
if it's going to provide services to anyone who walks in the door,
yeah, which we propose,
yeah. I mean, we said there's an invisible sign above the door that says, "If you're fucked up, you're welcome here."
Yeah,
you're fucked up. Feel fucked up. Come on in.
Yeah. And then it had a kind of natural life within a context.
I think 5 years is incredible. My organization only lasted 2 before it got totally co-opted.
Uh huh.
But again, yours was in 90 to 92.
Yeah.
See, you can say what happened with George Strait. I mean, at any given point in time, except perhaps in Nazi Germany, but even then too. I mean, there are always these little expressions of, left-wing progressive thought.
Yeah, I mean, publications have continued throughout the period, but they've always been failing, barely hanging on. And I've been a member of all of them.
Yes, I see Wolf is on the board of Pacific Current.
Right, yeah.
The Vancouver Review runs its first front page story, What's Left? It's an attack on Pacific Current. It's all accurate. Everything they say is accurate. They shouldn't have printed the article, or else that's what defines the left.
The complaints about Pacific Current are accurate. The article is sort of awful.
Yeah.
Though, I mean, he doesn't...
It should have been more satiric. It should have been
or he doesn't know
more serious.
Yeah, he doesn't know what he wants out of this guy, Paul.